You're listening to a sermon from New City Fellowship in Manassas, Virginia. New City Fellowship is a diverse community that proclaims the gospel and makes disciples for the glory of God and the renewal of our city. For more information, visit newcityfellowship.net.
So Lars preached on chapter 2, I think it was a couple, maybe even a month ago at this point or more. Becky's saying more, so probably more. And it's been even longer since we preached on Ruth chapter 1, so I'll do a brief recap. In chapter 1, we saw the joy of Naomi's life drain out. Her husband dies, her sons die, and she's left with two Moabite women as her family. She sends them on their way. She tries to send them packing because she's going to go back to Bethlehem. Orpah leaves, Ruth stays. And as they return, as they begin the journey returning to Bethlehem, we get to see just how cool Ruth is. She's a woman of character who has fully committed the rest of her life to serving God and Naomi. And in doing so, she pretty much sacrifices any chance, any reasonable expectation that she would have, that she might have a family of her own. God uses her love, and through her, Boaz as well, to embrace Naomi, wrapping her in his love and comfort, even through that difficult time. In chapter 2, we get to meet Boaz. He's a wealthy landowner, respected in the community, and one of the few men introduced in the Bible as worthy. Boaz cares for Ruth by publicly providing her protection and community when she had none. And this enables her to care for Naomi. And over the course of the barley and wheat harvests, probably 8 weeks by most estimations, Naomi starts to heal and starts to recover a little bit. Remember, at the start of chapter 2, Naomi's almost non-responsive. Ruth asks if she can go and glean in the fields, and she says, go. It's a pretty short conversation, especially when we see her talking so much in chapter 1. And this silence is notable when we compare it to Boaz's concern for her when he sees Ruth in the field for the first time. Boaz knows that without any sort of formal protective structure, Naomi's out there on her own, taking a big risk. And it's only when Naomi returns home at the end of the day does Naomi acknowledge the risks and the dangers at play when she instructs Ruth to stay close to Boaz's women, the women working for him. So in chapters 1 and 2, we see how Ruth and Boaz are caring for Naomi when she wouldn't even care for herself. And in chapter 3, we start to see the progression of how that impacts Naomi. We see Naomi soften at the end of chapter 2, and then I think chapter 3 is sort of a natural progression of that. So instead of reading the passage all in one go, we're going to break it up into a couple chunks. The first chunk will be sort of Naomi's plan, if you will. Then we'll have Ruth's response to that plan, and then finally how Boaz responds to Ruth. So let's read Ruth chapter 3, verses 1 through 5. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you that it might be well with you? Is not Boaz, our relative, with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." And she replied, "All that you say, I will do." Let's take this a few pieces at a time. So first off, let's think about Naomi's timing here. Naomi is aware of who Boaz was from the first day that Ruth gleaned in the field, and yet she waits till now to have this conversation with Ruth. Why is that? The simple answer might just be that Naomi wasn't feeling it in the moment. She was burned out and not really in a good place to be thinking about it. But I think there might be a little bit more to it. The author doesn't specify, so this is a little bit of conjecture, but it seems likely that Naomi is waiting to the end of the harvest to provide as much time for her to assess Boaz's character and for Boaz and Ruth to get to know each other without putting too much awkward social pressure on the situation. We don't really know how much Naomi would have known Boaz from her first time in Bethlehem before she left, before the famine, but it's at least been 10 years since she's seen him. You know, time is really the only best way to judge a character, and so maybe Boaz isn't really a great guy anymore. Maybe he never was. Maybe he's soured with old age, and so this time gives Naomi a chance to really understand who Boaz is today. The second part is that if Naomi waits any longer, she might miss the chance for Ruth and Boaz to interact in a more organic nature. Once the harvest finished, Boaz is going to go back to doing his normal job. He's going to leave the fields behind. He's going to go back into the city. And the opportunity for Ruth and Boaz to overlap naturally in a way that doesn't raise too many questions would be far less likely. And so I think there's a part of this time where Naomi's showing that she's a pretty wise woman. She knows how to understand the situation. Next, let's look at the guidance that Naomi gives to Ruth. Ruth is a cool story because there's real people, real events, real things happening, and yet the author is still really involved with how the story is told. It's sort of a cool combination. It's definitely not C-SPAN here, right? This isn't boring and dull and dry. I like C-SPAN, but Becky says it's boring. It's more like a drama. As if Chewie's here, I'd say a telenovela. There's a lot more suspense built into it. The author uses a lot of this to really, I think, drive home some of the points of the story. This is definitely also posed some challenges over the centuries as how people understand and interpret these passages. Specifically, the content in verses 3 and 4 have received a lot of attention. There's a wide range of perspectives, and I think a lot of it's overblown and some of it's pretty baseless. So I just want to address some of that so we're all on the same page. Much of it stands from the difficulty in understanding the cultural practices of the day in light of our own preconceived notions about where we are today. So if we look at verse 3 again, it says, "Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself. Put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking." So Naomi's instruction to wash and anoint yourself is interpreted by many as a bridal preparation. Take a shower, wash off the filth of the fields, maybe put on some perfume and a nice dress. While it's possible that that's part of the intent, certainly those things don't hurt your chances. It's more likely that this is Naomi's way of saying, put away your mourning clothes. Remember, Ruth was a widow. She was married to Naomi's son, and just per the cultural practices of the day, she would have been dressed as a widower at that time. And that's how Boaz would have met her. That's how he would have known her. That would have defined her cultural standing in a sense, if you will. So from chapters 1 and 2, we know that Ruth is intentionally deferring to Naomi. She even asks to go out and glean in the field so they don't starve. And so it's unlikely that she would have decided to put away these widow's clothes without first seeking the approval from Naomi. And here, Naomi actually takes the initiative and says, no, it's actually okay, you can do this. Like, she doesn't wait for Ruth to ask. Naomi takes that initiative. In the same way that Naomi took the initiative in chapter 1 to say, go back to your father's house. You don't have to stay here with me. I have nothing. And then the rest of verse 3 and verse 4 is, I think, quite practical. Naomi instructs Ruth on where she'll find Boaz that night and tells Ruth to wait until he lies down before approaching him. Again, it's difficult to fully understand all the nuances at play here, but Naomi's careful instructions make it clear that she has thought this through and is doing her best in the circumstance to ensure Ruth's success and to protect her at the same time. If Ruth had approached Boaz right away, while he was still celebrating the end of a presumably successful harvest, and he said no, she would have been humiliated and dishonored in front of the little community that she's been able to develop over the last 8 weeks. Approaching a tired and hungry man probably wasn't wise either. And so we can see that there's some practical advice here that Naomi has. By waiting for the end of the festivities, for things to sort of die down and calm down, Ruth has a chance to approach Boaz more discreetly. And if things go wrong, if Boaz tries to take advantage of her or abuse her, there's going to be others that are going to be sleeping nearby that she can call out to if she needs help. So it's sort of she's trying to balance the best she can given the circumstance. I also want to point out that nothing in the text indicates that Boaz is drunk. Certainly he's enjoyed a drink or two. I mean, the way ESV translated, it's eating and drinking, that his heart was merry. There are these expressions that I think we naturally assume this means he's drunk. But from what I've been able to use the Hebrew word in, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, so take that with a grain of salt, it certainly doesn't imply a sense of intoxication. It doesn't mean it can't, but in this case, it doesn't imply it. Furthermore, everything we're ever told about Boaz, and I think this is perhaps the strongest argument, is that he is a man of good character. He is described, he's, I think, one of the only men in the Bible who has such a glowing review all throughout. That doesn't mean Boaz didn't have his own issues and his own demons to wrestle with, but he is defined in this chapter as a man of character, and so I think that should be our through line as we understand some of these texts. Naomi would have been able to observe his character, how he responds, how he acts in the last 8 weeks, and I wonder if she didn't do a little bit of sleuthing just to get a better idea of who he was. Again, that's conjecture on my part, but Naomi seems very invested here in protecting Ruth and caring for her in a potentially tricky situation. the last part of Naomi's instruction, is she's telling her watch where he lies down. Again, I think this further drives home that same point. It's sort of dark, there's not great lighting, it's probably just a lot of smaller fires, and so if she ends up approaching the wrong man, that could be pretty bad. And so just figuring out, okay, make sure you have the right guy before you approach him in the dark, wearing a cloak, you know, midnight or whatever. I think it really, this is a practical instruction here. Okay, so this is how sort of Naomi sets things up. Let's look at the second section now and see how Ruth responds. So Ruth 3, verses 6 through 9. So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman at his feet. He said, "Who are you?" She answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." We started with Naomi's plan, and now we see sort of Ruth responding in action. The way the author writes verse 6 and 7 highlights how closely she followed Naomi's instruction, but in verse 9, we have a bit of a twist. Now remember, at the end of verse 4, Naomi says, "And he will tell you what to do." But Ruth doesn't give Boaz the chance to respond. Immediately after identifying herself, Ruth makes her intentions clear. She asks Boaz that he answer his own prayer from chapter 2 and cover her, and by extension, Naomi, with his wings. Let's also stop and think about Boaz's question in verse 9. Who are you? On the surface, it seems like Boaz is maybe just confused, and he was startled in the middle of the night. He probably is a little confused. Who is this at his feet? It's dark, and Ruth is wearing a cloak, masking her identity. Ruth's answer demonstrates that she knew that he was also asking, "Why are you here? What is your purpose?" You see, the threshing floor had a seedy reputation, if you'll allow me the pun. Late into the night, prostitutes would appear at the edge. The nature of the threshing floor being removed from the city, you know, it was a place where some of those things were far more likely to happen. And so Boaz is asking, "Why are you here?" He's trying to understand what's going on, making sure he doesn't get into trouble here. And it's interesting, in chapter 2, we see Boaz's generosity here on full display. He invites others in, he says, "Join me in this effort, let's care for and provide for Ruth and Naomi as a community." But now, in the dark of the night, we get to see who Boaz really is. I mean, it's one thing to be generous in public, it's another thing to act with integrity and to be generous in private. And it's pretty cool to see how Boaz responds when there's really not a lot of protection for Ruth here in this situation. The last thing I want to note about this section is how Ruth and Boaz actually conduct themselves. Again, this is another one of those, I think, big discussion points for people reading through Ruth. There's no doubt that the language used initially by Naomi here and now by the author is intentionally suggestive. In verse 7, we're set at the threshing floor. We have the phrases "lie down," "uncover," and "his feet." With each addition, those listening to the story would have felt the sexual tension mount. And again, I'm glad this is not a family Sunday. I mean, great, great timing. After all, you know, it wouldn't be a drama if there wasn't some tension, right? And so I think that the original audience would have, one, enjoyed that from a story's perspective, but I think that's part of what the author is using to engage his listeners in the story. There are many people who have studied the Bible a great deal who have drawn the conclusion that Ruth and Boaz were intimate with each other that night. Some will go so far as to even say that this is their wedding night. And I think that's pretty misguided. I think those ideas take the scripture and they stretch it far too far. And so let's work through a couple of those things. Yes, Boaz is sleeping on the threshing floor, a place that Hosea identifies with prostitution, but not everyone sleeping there was looking for the same thing. Boaz is there because he just had a huge harvest after a long famine, and that represents the majority of his material wealth in the world. And so he can't just leave that. He's got to take care of it until it's been packaged and stored properly in a more safe environment. The expression "lie down," even today, has a bit of a subtle meaning to it. The expression "cover one's feet" had become a euphemism for using the bathroom with one's robes. We see that in 1 Samuel 24 and 3 when King Saul goes to the bathroom in a cave while King David is watching, and we also see it in Judges 3:24. Similarly, the expression "uncover nakedness" is almost always linked to some sort of sexual perversion, as we see in Genesis 9:22 when Moses' son Ham saw the nakedness of his father. Finally, we get to the phrase "his feet." Yes, in some contexts, the feet carry the double meaning for male genitalia, and it's reasonable to assume that the listeners to this story would have been sitting at the edge of their seat waiting to see what happens next. By combining "uncover" and "feet," some believe that the author is actually recording something far more intimate here. However, we're not taking seriously the story as a whole, what we know about the characters, and what this text actually says. So there is a lot of suspense here. I'm not denying that, but again, I think it's just that. To believe that Ruth and Boaz were intimate, we would need to ignore everything that the author has told us about Boaz and Ruth. Not only is Boaz introduced as a man of worth, but he tells Ruth that very night, as we'll read in a moment, that all his fellow townsmen know that she is a woman who is worthy. Outside of Jesus, no one gets this kind of endorsement. Additionally, the story provides the most reasonable answer. By uncovering Boaz's feet, Ruth didn't have to shake Boaz awake or make a noise. The cool breeze would have been enough to wake him without startling him and drawing unnecessary attention to others. This might seem deep in the weeds, and it is, but when you're looking through Ruth, a lot of people will get hung up on these things, and so I just wanted to cover some of that so we're all on the same page. The last thing that I think is interesting to note here about their conduct is how Boaz responds. Boaz actually points out that there's another man who has the responsibility to redeem and marry Ruth ahead of Boaz. He has sort of the first right to that. Boaz goes out of his way to protect her and send her home safely, as we'll see later, so that no one will think any less of her. Boaz is extremely intent on protecting Ruth and, by extension, Naomi. His words and actions reported all throughout the story, I think, are consistent with that. And so I think when we read the story, when we understand the story, we need to look at the whole story as well and understand that in its context. Okay, so let's read Ruth chapter 3, verses 10 through 13, and see how Boaz responds. And he said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask. For all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. And now it is true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good. But if he will not redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning." So Boaz's response should catch our attention a little bit. That first kindness he refers to is likely how Ruth stuck by Naomi in chapter 1 by providing for her in a foreign land. In essence, her sacrificial love and loyalty to Naomi. And now as Ruth has asked Boaz to act as a redeemer, he knows that she's asking for more than just marriage. Not only would Boaz become her husband, but Boaz would have been able to redeem their former land, the land that Naomi left behind when she left Bethlehem the first time. And restore it for their family and then for the generations that come after. Now, I'll be the first to admit that there's a lot about inheritance laws in the Old Testament that get pretty dicey pretty quick, and I'm not going to be able to do a great job of explaining all of them, especially because the laws weren't all instituted at the same time, and they weren't all in effect to the same degree at the same time, especially during the time of the judges, where Israel had a penchant of just doing whatever they wanted. There was a lot more freedom, so to speak, or free-spiritedness in Israel as a people. And so how all those laws and rules, was this a levirate marriage, was it not? Was it a kinsman redeemer? I mean, just a lot of those things. I'm not going to get deep into the weeds there, but in effect, Ruth is asking for protection for her and Naomi. That much we know is clear. Boaz understands that when he responds as well. So notice here how Boaz also flips the script. Initially, Naomi tells Ruth that Boaz will tell you what to do, but now Boaz is telling Ruth that he will do all that she asks, acknowledging that everyone knows that she's a worthy woman. The humility and lack of pride exhibited by both Ruth and Boaz is honestly pretty refreshing. So up until now, the book of Ruth has been told from the perspective of Naomi and Ruth. But in verse 12, we get a glimpse into Boaz's thoughts, what's been going through his mind over the last few weeks. After assuring Ruth that he would endeavor to marry her, he points out that there's another redeemer closer in line than him. Maybe Naomi and Ruth knew this, maybe they didn't, maybe they just were hoping that this would work out anyway. But Boaz clearly knew what was going on. After being woken up in the middle of the night by a random woman after an exhausting season of work, he knows exactly who stands between him and Ruth. I think it's safe to say that he's probably thought this through a little bit before this night. it's also interesting that he doesn't make promises he can't keep. He's honest and direct with Ruth. He doesn't idolize marriage with Ruth or let his desires take center stage, but rather continues to properly prioritize living rightly over his immediate desires. He trusts in God to care for Ruth while working to secure the desired outcome. He doesn't take shortcuts, and he doesn't string Ruth along. Boaz is guided by principle here. So let's see what this looks like in action as we finish the rest of chapter 3. So she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. And he said, "Let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor." And he said, "Bring a garment that you are wearing and hold it out." So she held it out, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city, and when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, "How did you fare, my daughter?" Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, "These 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, 'You must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law.'" She replied, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." See how concerned Boaz is for Ruth's honor. By waiting until the early morning and by giving her grain, he gives her a good excuse if someone was to recognize her in the dim morning light. Not only does he protect her as she returns to Naomi, but he sends her back full, calling to mind Naomi's words in chapter 1 when she says the Lord has brought her back to Bethlehem empty. Knowingly or not, Boaz gently reminds Naomi that though she felt empty when she returned home, the Lord has been working through Ruth to fill Naomi to the point of overflowing. The story of Ruth is pretty awesome. I've been impressed as I go through it and I read through it with our community group this past year. For a story that almost never mentions God directly, we get to see so clearly how God is working every step of the way. At the end of chapter 1, the author notes that Naomi and Ruth arrived at Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Ooh, what a coincidence. How could that have happened? And in chapter 2, the text says, and she happened to come to the part of field belonging to Boaz. Just, I think, two pretty salient examples of God clearly working in their midst. And the way it's written in the Hebrew would have, I think, made this very clear to the initial audience. That God is at work even when they couldn't see it, just as he is at work in our lives when we can't see it. It's a pretty cool picture of God's sovereignty, but don't stop there. The lives of Ruth, the Naomi, and Boaz, they beautifully blend God's sovereignty with human responsibility. So last week, Will preached through a portion of Psalm 37, where he sort of walked us through what it means to wait on the Lord. What does that look like? And in verse 3 of that psalm, it says, "Trust in the Lord and do good." This is the picture we see here with Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz. They demonstrate their trust in God all throughout the story by acting in faith, knowing that the results are in the hands of someone else. They don't wait for things to be right in their own lives, but they seek to bless those around them. The whole book demonstrates this act of faith, but chapter 3, I think, puts it on center stage. We see Naomi tell Ruth her plan, knowing full well that it's up to Ruth and God working through her to see it through to fruition. We see Ruth trusting Naomi's instincts when she follows Naomi's plan, and we see Ruth place herself entirely at the mercy of Boaz, trusting that he is a man of God who will honor her and not abuse her. But it isn't just the widowed and the marginalized that live by faith. Boaz demonstrates his faith in God by not taking matters into his own hands, when he very well could have. He could have attempted to circumnavigate the system and marry Ruth, hoping that the other man either wouldn't notice or just wouldn't care. But instead, he places his desires aside and effectively says, "Your will be done, Lord." Their actions are marked by a trust and faith, but it's not blind. They're not just going willy-nilly. Naomi took 8 weeks to get reacquainted with Boaz before she suggested her plan to Ruth. Ruth didn't demand Naomi's approval to put aside her mourning clothes when they arrived in Bethlehem, and Ruth didn't try to find a husband on her own timing. Instead, Ruth prioritizes sacrificial love and care for Naomi instead of her own desires. Boaz trusted God to provide the right husband for Ruth and the right spouse for himself, but simultaneously, as we'll see in chapter 4 later, he dealt very shrewdly with the other man who would have potentially been able to redeem Ruth. They didn't sit at home and wait and hope wishfully. They trusted God actively. They engaged with the world wisely and not from a place of fear. I think that's a pretty cool example for us today. As we think about all of the big decisions in life and the small decisions in life, we often fall prey to maybe one of two extremes: action without faith or faith without action. In the first extreme, we operate with a focus on control. We decide that what we're going to do, how we're going to do it, when we're going to do it, we might even spend a lot of time planning, thinking, preparing, you know, just making this perfect situation so things go just the way that we want them. We think that if we plan and do everything in our own strength, that it's just going to work out great. I often fall into this trap daily. I isolate myself from others and from God until the weight becomes so much that I can't bear it and I break. How much of this is arrogance and an unwillingness to recognize our own needs to depend on God? In the second extreme, we operate in a false sense of spirituality. We trust that God will provide and care for ourselves, and rightly so, but we fail to ask. Maybe we say to ourselves, "Why should I have that hard conversation with a family member or a friend? Why should I risk my own comfort and emotional exhaustion when I know that God is ultimately in control and there's nothing I can do to change things? If it's meant to be, then God will make it happen." We forget that God works through the hands and feet of his creation, and we are still responsible for engaging with the challenges of this world. God doesn't need you to accomplish his purpose, but he uses us if we're bold enough to act in faith. Maybe this is fueled by misunderstanding of God's sovereignty. I don't need to worry about what school my kids attend, or the direction of my career, because I know that God's going to take care of me. It's almost a Jesus take the wheel mindset, if you will. But what we see lived out in the very real and challenging circumstances of Ruth are three people who choose to trust God and act in faith. Faith is not passive. It must be grounded in action. And I know we talk about faith a lot as Christians, but I think it's helpful to remind us what faith actually is. And Hebrews 11:1 paints a fairly simple picture for us, saying, "Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." The rest of chapter 11 goes on to provide examples of faith giving way to action, starting with Abel and working through Noah, Abraham, Sarah, and Rahab, the mother of Boaz, just to list a few. It's a long chapter, but I'd encourage you to spend some time this week in your personal devotions reading through Hebrews 11. Look at the examples of their lives and how faith spurred them to action. They weren't perfect. You don't have to look very far to find issues there. Abraham, King David, had many issues, and they're considered to be some of the top. But yet their lives are so grounded in their faith. They're defined by their faith, and that results in action. Will mentioned Noah last week. When he set out to build the ark, which took decades, it required that he trust God day after day, year after year, decade after decade. Well, meanwhile, everyone else thought he was a fool. When Rahab protected the spies that Joshua sent to Jericho, she put her life on the line, having faith that they would remember her during the battle and not destroy her and her family. So after reading through this wonderful list of the heroes of the faith, so to speak, we get to Hebrews chapter 12, where verses 1 and 2 say, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." As if all the examples in chapter 11 weren't enough, the author of Hebrews reminds us that a life of faith is like a race. God is in control, yes. God is sovereign, of course. But you will never cross the finish line if you don't run with perseverance what has been set out before you. What is holding you back from a life of faith this morning? What sin do you need to cast off that so easily entangles? I'll confess this is stuff that I deal with regularly. In fact, I think even more so now in the role of elder, just struggling with all of these anxieties and my own arrogance and pride and not being willing to live by faith, but trusting in myself. As we think about New City and the path forward in the coming months, it's a great tie-in, it's a great parallel. I know that there are many unanswered questions. You know, we think we might have a little bit more time with Chewy and Carla. That's wonderful. We think we're going to have a pastoral search committee and we might have some ideas to sort of work that through. That's great. But there's still a lot of uncertainty. There's still many things that we don't know. We don't even know how these things are going to shake out. And so I want to encourage all of us, myself included, to relish the opportunity that we've been given by God to trust him. And I think that's really what this is. This is an opportunity for us as a people of God to trust God. Not just with the easy things, not just with the stuff we don't really care about, with the stuff that's very central for who we are. Let the examples of Naomi, Boaz, and especially Ruth encourage us to persevere as we seek to glorify God in this region. The last thing I want to note here, and I think this is pretty interesting, notice at the end of chapter 3, we don't actually know who Ruth is going to marry. We end that sort of episode, so to speak, unknown. Ruth comes back, she's got all this barley, they're loading it up into their Tupperware around the kitchen table, and she still doesn't know who she's going to marry. Boaz says, if he doesn't, I will. So she's going to get married, but she has no idea who she's going to get married to. I don't think any of us can really imagine what that must be like today. And yet Ruth waits. The Bible doesn't say that she liked waiting or she had some fun, you know, girls' night or activity planned to keep her distracted. We don't really know. All that we know is that she waited and trusted that Boaz would take care of it. As you go this week back into sort of the messed up quagmire that is our lives at times, let's go out knowing that God is actively engaged in the work of our lives and that he longs for us to place our trust in him each day. Whether that's patiently waiting for something to pass like Ruth was at the end of chapter 3, or maybe that's taking a bold step of faith like Ruth at the beginning of chapter 3. Either way, let's live lives and let's engage with the world in a way that says, I have faith in God to provide for whatever the situation might be, knowing that we will not be put to shame. So in a moment, we're going to have communion here. As you approach, you can take the cup and the bread, and you'll take them back to your chair. but I want us to think about communion and how we treat communion. The life of Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz show us an example, just one example of many, of what it means to trust in God. As we approach the communion table, we have an opportunity to demonstrate this trust publicly. And that's partly what communion is. As we eat the bread and drink the wine, we proclaim to all around us that we believe in the death of Christ on the cross and his resurrection 3 days later. Something that sounds honestly pretty ludicrous at face value to those who don't know Christ. We also know that we're reaffirming our belief that one day soon, Christ will return to judge the world and call his own home. Communion is a symbol of our trust in God, and so if you don't proclaim to follow Jesus, I'd encourage you to remain in your seat and also use this time to consider your relationship with God. He longs for you to trust in him. What stands in the way? So with that, let's read Luke's account of the first communion on the night when Jesus was betrayed. And he took the cup, and when he'd given thanks, he said, "Take this and divide it amongst yourselves. For I tell you that from now on I will not drink of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes." And he took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to them, saying, "This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." And likewise the cup, after they had eaten, saying, "The cup is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood. Come forward as you're ready."